got a little tradition here in East Side Insight that the last sip before Christmas try to talk about something from the life of the Buddha. Because, you know, this is Jesus Christ's birthday coming up, might as well honor the, while we're busy honoring great beings, let's honor the Buddha also. So, wanted to explore with you a area of choices the Buddha made and how that may help us with our own choices. And let me ask, how many people know the rough life of the Buddha? Yes, out there? Some? Pretty much? Okay. Short version is, he grew up in privilege in what is now northern India about 2,600 years ago, and abandoned this privilege to become a wandering mendicant, a monastic, and pursue awakening on the spiritual path. And before he awakened, became the Buddha, referred to himself as a bodhisattva. So that's what I'll be trying to do to make sense of what I'm going to say. And he awakened and became the Buddha in his late 30s and taught for 40 years while crisscrossing the Ganges Valley between Sravasti, where he grew up, and Bodh Gaya, where he awakened. So about 200 miles back and forth, all around, all kind of different places. But he made all these choices along the way, and also getting there, getting to the point of being awakened. And it's pretty interesting. Because what's interesting about it is how similar it is to our realities on the path in terms of making choices. Because we have choices to make in terms of, you know, do we practice or not? What do we do? Everybody was just talking about choices in terms of their encounters. And his situation is very parallel to ours in a lot of ways. So it isn't so like esoteric. Because as an essential point, as a young man, he was supplied with, and by the way, I'm going to quote quite a bit, because I like to do that, because it's cool stuff from the suttas. But he had everything he needed for a happy and successful worldly life and to be in a position of power. He was just set up to do that. But he eventually chose to do something else and to go deeper. So he let that go. Because I don't want to say we have to let that go because we're lay people, so we're probably going to be that radical, but we can choose to refocus. And for his time, he had pretty, you know, access to wealth and power. And, you know, from a certain point of view, that's kind of how we are. Even though I know we all this seems humble and mundane, but in our lives here in the 21st century in Western Washington, but, you know, compared to much of the world, I don't know how many of you folks have traveled in other parts of the world, but I mean, we're pretty much made in the shade here, you know, in terms of most of Africa, big chunk of Latin America, and a lot of Asia, to have places where we can live, where we're secure, safe, warm and dry, and fed, and even have a vehicle, is extraordinary. So we are pretty privileged. In recounting his early life, the Buddha says, and you know, it's so funny, I remember this one part of it from reading the suttas, and I could not find it, but I suddenly, you know how you search? So I was looking in, this is just an aside, but in the Kindle app, and I suddenly went, the word delicate, that's the word. And that only came up one time in the entire Samyutta Nikaya. And so that's what I was looking for. But he says, monastics, I was delicately nurtured, most delicately nurtured, extremely delicately nurtured. At my father's residence, lotus ponds were made just for my enjoyment. In one of them, blue lotuses bloomed, in another, red lotuses, and in a third, white lotuses. I used no sandalwood unless it came from Varanasi. And my headdress, jacket, lower garment, and upper garment were made of cloth from Varanasi. By day and night, a white canopy was held over me, so that cold and heat, dust, grass, and dew would not settle on me. I had three mansions, one for the winter, one for the summer, and one for the rainy season. I spent the 4 months of the rains in the rainy season mansion. being entertained by musicians, none of whom were male, and I did not leave the mansion. While in other people's homes, slaves, workers, and servants were given broken rice together with sour gruel for their meals. In my father's residence, they were given choice hill rice, meat, and boiled rice. At that time, I was a young lad with clear skin and dark hair in the prime of youth, 29 years of age, roaming about, well adorned, and enjoying myself to the utmost. So I just love that, because that's just like almost like the purest example of someone just enjoying, I mean, having this ridiculously amazing situation and enjoying it. And so he wasn't, you know, because a lot of times people out in the world, when someone turns to the spiritual path, they say, oh, that's because they were troubled. Oh, that's because they couldn't hack it. So they're doing this thing. And, you know, I've come back from retreats to the newsroom when I speak to journalists, and people would say, oh, welcome back to reality. And I was sort of, I actually said, well, dudes, that was reality. But, you know, there's this thing people have. But he, the Buddha himself was like, he was fine. I mean, he was fine. And I love it. You know, you could wonder, I mean, of course, we don't know what exactly was written down and carried by memory for several hundred years and then written down, if he really said that or not. But some of it is so specific that, you know, I mean, the whole thing about the cloth, you know, the silk from Varanasi, that's where there's big silk markets in Varanasi to this day. It's so specific that it's hard to think it was made up. But anyway. So he wasn't seeking a spiritual path because he was agonized or in pain. He was actually having fun. And he was with all these dancing girls and, you know, the whole deal. So the nature of this choosing, the choice he made, is a constant theme in the Dharma. And it's an important thing moment by moment for us as we make constant choices. And choosing the spiritual path despite pleasant circumstance is always also a theme in Buddhist cosmology. And some of you may know, in Buddhist cosmology, there are six realms of being, and one of them is the Deva realms. And so the idea is we can move among all these realms of being according to our karma and the winds of karma. And we could be an animal, we could be in a hell realm, we could be in a human realm as we are, or in a Deva realm. And the deal with Deva realms is they're so pleasant. It's just totally delightful, like just consistently, delightfully delightful, so that most people in the Deva realms, they don't practice at all. They just kind of hang out and they just play and carvat and eat and everything. And then suddenly it's over. And that's the worst thing of all when they realize, oh my God, it's over. But when it's so delightful, people don't usually practice. But the Buddha did. And how we navigate that is actually really important. It's important. And this is, you know, here we are in 2021 in our crazy consumer culture, where if we paid attention to it, we'd be convinced that as long as we have youth, physical beauty, and a credit card, we're going to be happy. And that's what they're trying to tell us. And, you know, I just met someone recently who had been doing that and, you know, understood how much they were manipulating and had a big change of heart because of it. So it's powerful, powerful stuff. But almost just because he had reached the summit of worldly satisfaction, he began to wonder what the point was. And that's in some ways, I think, also what drives us, because we wonder, what's the point? Where's this taking me? And there's some versions of his life story that say he wanted to travel, like you probably heard, wanted to travel outside the palace, and it's actually not in the suttas anywhere. So it is an interesting question if that really happened or not. Analayo has this theory that because people used to, traveling storytellers in India used to hold up pictures of these perspectives that the Buddha had with a sick person and a dying person, an old person, and sort of made up this story that he went out and saw them. So I don't know. But anyway, in the suttas, it doesn't say that. It's sort of more inward, but it's the same theme. So I'm going to read a little bit. These encounters with the unsatisfactoriness of the human condition that he was looking toward, even though at that moment he was 21, made in a shade. And he says it. He said, amid such splendor and a delicate life, it occurred to me, an uninstructed worldling, which means someone not practicing, though him or herself, subject to old age, not exempt from old age, feels repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when he sees another one who is old, overlooking his own situation. Now I too am subject to old age and am not exempt from old age. Such being the case, if I were to feel repelled, humiliated, and disgusted when seeing another who is old, that would not be proper for me. When I reflected thus, my intoxication with youth was completely abandoned. Isn't that amazing? Logic, train of thought. And then he goes on, when an untaught, ordinary person who is subject to sickness, not safe from sickness, sees another who is sick, that person is shocked, humiliated, and disgusted, for he forgets that he or she himself is no exception. But the Buddha realizes, I too am subject to sickness, not safe from sickness, and it cannot befit me to be shocked, humiliated, and disgusted on seeing another who is sick. When I considered this, the vanity of health entirely left me. I thought, and lastly, when an untaught ordinary man who is subject to death, not safe from death, sees another who is dead, he is shocked, humiliated, and disgusted, for he forgets that he himself is no exception. But I too am subject to death, not safe from death, and so it cannot befit me to be shocked, humiliated, and disgusted on seeing another who is dead. When I consider this, the vanity of life entirely left me. So he just goes through this internal process of looking at this transience and seeing how unsatisfactory it is. And, you know, what's interesting for us is, you know, we too have opportunities to do that. And it's good to do that, you know, just to check how much we're lulled into forgetting. I know I've said this before, but it's okay. One of my Tibetan teachers would say, never forget, never be surprised by what you already know. And this sort of falls into that category. So isn't this interesting? The vanity of youth, the vanity of health, and the vanity of life. And you know, we look around and see these things dropping away among people. I mean, it's funny for me. I'm 73, and at this point, people are like dying right and left around me that are my contemporaries. I mean, it's just like, it's happening. I mean, literally think, oh, if I die a few years from now, there'll be so many fewer people to go to my memorial service. And it's really like, it's really immediate. I mean, people are, it's happening, you know? And then we all know circumstances can happen so suddenly. We read about all the time, you know, corporate restructuring, a divorce, a bus, a bike accident. And suddenly everything that seemed pleasant and predictable, just a snap of the fingers, isn't. And so, you know, if we think we can depend on circumstance, we're fooling ourselves. And the Buddha, he got that. In the middle of all this amazing, happy situation, he got it. And here on the east side, I think it's kind of interesting, you know, like all these crazy expensive, crazy wealthy people, you know, they spend millions of dollars to go weightless in outer space for 30 seconds, or, you know, you see Lamborghini SUVs and driving around and there's giant yachts and aircraft and all this stuff, and then people get old and die. I mean, Paul Allen, you know, died at 65. Didn't work out for him. I heard him one time at a presentation, and someone asked, it was a town hall in Seattle, and the interviewer, who was a tech reporter, and he said, well, what can you tell us about your yachts? And he said, oh, just too big and too many. That was what he could tell us about his yachts. So, you know, so there's a whole question of choice there. And this turns us back to how we practice minute by minute, because the Buddha wasn't fooled. The Buddha wasn't fooled by these pleasant circumstances, and he looked within. So, you know, this helps turn us toward what we do. What we do. The Buddha says, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, being myself subject to birth, aging, ailment, death, sorrow, and defilement, I sought after what was also subject to these things. Then I thought, why being myself subject to birth, aging, ailment, death, sorrow, and defilement, do I seek after what is also subject to these things? Suppose, being myself subject to these things, seeing danger in them, I sought after the unborn, unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, undefiled, supreme ceasing of bondage, nibbana. Isn't that cool? I just love it how incisive he is. How about, instead of following that which you cannot depend on, how about do the opposite? And this is where, you know, it's hard. I mean, this is where it's hard practicing in the 21st century, because we're all kind of gathered together in this little group of 15 people, or 14, no, 15, because there's the Sean and Bruce duo. So, and then out there, there's not much support, you know? It's going uphill. It's going uphill. And it may be natural for an almost awakened being like the Buddha to have a clear compass and know where this is taking them. Let's see where the practice is taking. It's hard for us. It's not so easy. We're pulled and tugged, and this is not even in our culture. You know, if we were growing up in Thailand with a wad in our village, it might be more obvious, or Tibet, at least before the invasion, be more obvious. But here, it's a challenge to turn toward that which we have not tasted yet, or only a little bit, but to keep doing it. So that's why we gather, you know, that's why we do this, is to help us resonate off each other and kind of tune into each other and help us with our choices, because that's what the theme is tonight. But even in our own tradition, some of the greatest leaders, they pushed uphill themselves very individually in their realization of the path. For instance, Ajahn Buddhadasa, some of you may know, is one of the great Thai masters of the 20th century. And most of his formative practice wasn't like with some great teacher. It was he's near Swan Mok. That's where his center was, which is in the south of Thailand. And he just went off in the woods and found this wreck of an abandoned wat and spent years. I've seen photographs of it. It was just ghastly. I mean, it was all falling apart, and he found a place under the roof that didn't leak, and he just practiced there all by himself, and he just, like, did it. I mean, he just did it. It was not cushy. It was uncomfortable and wet and humid and buggy and everything. But that was what he did. Very individualistic. He didn't really have a main teacher, as far as I know. I'm not clear on that part. But he used the suttas, and he practiced. So it's, in a weird kind of way, it's not that different. It's not that different. And he was afraid sometimes, but I've read some stuff about it, but he just kept going. He kept going. And, you know, that's kind of our option, to keep going. And Ajahn Chah, another great Thai master of the 20th century, he has his teacher with Ajahn Mun. He only studied with him one day. He, like, came and met with him, studied with him one day, and left the next day. That was it. And much of his early years, he was in, how do you pronounce this, in Tudong, which is when monastics wander through the forests of Thailand, pretty much like one or two all by themselves, just existing on whatever alms food would have happened in some little village they'd stumble on. And other than that, on their own. Pretty radical. And I know people, I mean, this Ajahn Tanisibo, he's done Tudong in Australia and on the East Coast, like, of U.S., like, just wandering like that and depending on alms food. It's pretty amazing. So it's still happening. And Ajahn Chah, he was, I mean, it was his biography, by the way. What's the name of it? Everybody know? Stillness Flowing. That's it. It's really wonderful. And it was pretty hairy. I mean, it was hungry, it was cold, didn't get meals, isolated, all that kind of stuff. And I don't know how many of you know, but basically monastics have three robes and an umbrella with a mosquito net. That's it. And so it's a pretty big umbrella, but still you're in the rain under the mosquito net. That's it. And so there's one moment when this was when there were a lot of tigers and there was a lot of forest still in Thailand, and there was a tiger, like, outside the mosquito net. I mean, right there, so close for hours that he could smell its breath. And the tire was just on the verge of taking him out, but and he was like totally terrified, but he just had to, you know, as people were saying, be mindful of his bodily feelings. And finally the tiger decided not to eat him and left. So in the point being that he chose, you know, those are two of the strongest West, you know, the two of the monastics, Dharma leaders, Ajahns, who have made the most impact in the West, and both of them really self-initiated to an astonishing degree. So it's not like we're that different. So back to the Bodhisattva. The Buddha was also on his own because his sense of where he was going was not in that culture. And he studied with two of the great masters, and they, you know, went as far as they could go with concentration practices. And he knew there was more, and he was just flying blind, kind of. So he was completely, completely on his own. And as some of you know, he, you know, did not eat to the point where he could touch his backbone from the front. And there's this great description. He was so emaciated from eating like one grain of rice a day that his eyeballs were deep in his socket and he almost died. And then he decided maybe that wasn't the way to go because he was about to die. And it didn't help that Mara, M-A-R-A, kept showing up. And so Mara, interesting figure in Buddha Dharma. So who is Mara? You know, maybe a deity, maybe a metaphor, maybe a being. I don't know. You know, I'm not sure. I do not know. But Mara is, in terms of the suttas, this entity, this, you know, being who keeps showing up and trying to discourage the Buddha. This happens before he awakens. It happens while he's awakening, and it happens still after he awakens. It never happens, never stops happening. So sometimes I look at Mara as like my own Mara, like it's me, you know, it's me shooting myself down, and how do I respond? Or trying to trip myself up. How do I respond? I think that's a good way to look at it, because we all have our own internal Mara trying to trip us up. And often, you know, if Mara might be ourself trying to encourage us off the path, you know, maybe just one more movie or one more slice of pie or whatever our thing is, instead of whatever practice we may feel like it's time to do, you know, those choices. How do we do that? So the last hours and days leading up to his awakening were difficult for the Buddha, and Mara did everything possible to dislodge him. The Buddha says, or the Bodhisattva at this point says, as I strove to subdue myself beside the broad, cannot pronounce, Niranjara River, which is in Bodhgaya, absorbed unflinchingly to gain the true ceasing of bondage here, Mara came and spoke to me with words all garbed in pity, thus, oh, you are thin and you are pale and you are in death's presence too. 1,000 parts are pledged to death, but life still holds one part of you. What can you do by struggling now? The path of struggling is too rough and difficult and hard to bear. So Mara's just trying to like talk him out of it, basically. It's too hard. Just, you know, go eat something or go have fun. But the Buddha replies, O evil one, O cousin of the negligent, you have come here for your own ends. How could a person inclined to sensual pleasures who has seen the source from where suffering springs? Having known acquisition as a tie in the world, a person who trains for its removal. And there's this repeated thing where Mara's busted, and he's sad and disappointed. He disappears. He slinks off. He slumps to the ground, puts his head down, all kinds of things. It happens over and over again in the suttas. So, and, you know, and it doesn't show up here, but there's this whole thing, I see you, Mara. He often says, I see you, Mara. And it's actually a really cool thing to incorporate in your own practice. And when we're playing a trick with ourselves, you can say, ah, I see you, Mara. It's very useful. But the Buddha's saying, you know, once you've seen the vision of the path, once you've seen the undependability of samsaric phenomena, how can we go back? Where does it lead? It doesn't lead anywhere useful. So it's sort of like no choice. It's that thing, especially in Tibetan practice, you know, they say practice is like a snake in a tube. Once you're in the tube, you can't go out. You got to go forward. There's no option anymore. And that's kind of how it is. So Mara doesn't give up. So that suggests that even as we make progress on the path, the possibility of falling back is always there. So we'll figure out, you know, as we grow, new ways of ignorance will arise, or layers of ourself will confront us, and we have to keep on keeping on. For there's this really interesting thing in the suttas where when the Buddha's awakened, and he's in a small hut near the Himalayas, and remember, he was a prince in training, so he still had this background, and during his life, he's always having these discussions with kings. The three main kings in the area, he has these ongoing engagements with. So and a lot of the royalty of the Sakya clan end up being monastics also. So there's a whole lot of like high level discussion going on. So he still has this, and he says, oh, out of the blue, this thought arises in his mind. So I wonder, is it possible to exercise rulership righteously without killing and without instigating others to kill, without confiscating, without instigating others to confiscate, without sorrowing and without causing sorrow? Just this like thought out of the blue arises. And Mara jumps on it, just appears out on there. Oh, since you're saying that, he says, Venerable Sir, let the Blessed One exercise rulership righteously. He said, well, drop this robe stuff, go back, run the kingdom. Just boom, he's right there, convincing him, trying to convince him to stop being a monastic, all this silly meditation stuff, and go do that thing. You could do it well. And then he says, And Venerable Sir, if the Blessed One wishes, he need only resolve that Himalaya, the king of the mountains, should become gold, and it would turn to gold, and everybody would be rich, and what a great ruler you'd be. But the Buddha sees right through this and says, if there were a mountain made of gold, made entirely of solid gold, not double this would suffice for one. So he's saying, if you had a mountain of gold, these people, they want two, and it would not take care of anything. But I think what's so beautiful about all this and sort of helpful for us is this persistence, you know, because this stuff keeps coming up for the awakened Buddha that he has to deal with. So I think where it helps us is remember that when stuff keeps coming up for us, that's okay. That's how it is. That's how it was for the Buddha. And we just keep going on. So he doesn't give up. And that's sort of the secret of the spiritual path, is not giving up. You know, just continuing. Because it's like built into it that we're going to have a mixture of uplift. You know, everyone talked about amazing things this earlier, that uplift of ways that they changed that were effective in difficult situations, and difficulty. That's going to happen too. Difficulty is going to happen. And that's just how it is. But the difficulty is usually a matter of our own kleshas, our own conditioning, our own karmas. That's what we bump up against. That's what the real difficulties aren't external, they're internal. And it's the very nature of unfolding that we bump up against these coagulations we have. So, you know, for me, I mean, I turn toward the Buddha a lot. And I was, you know, very fortunate. I've got a chance to do pilgrimage in India a couple of times. So it's kind of, if you ever get a chance to go to Sarvasti, please do. Because that's an amazing place. That's where he did more rains retreats than anywhere else. 24 rains retreats, and most of the suttas, especially in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's like every other sutta, it's there. So you get this powerful sense of presence. It's like it hasn't gone away. It's amazing. So anyway, I sort of turned toward the Buddha a lot, just this sense of constancy in the middle of challenges, and it helps extrapolate that into 2021 here. And he was, I think we're almost done, yep. And he was emphatic about the potential outcome, about the possibilities. It's like all through the suttas, he's like encouraging. He's really encouraging. Even though so much of what we talk about is about the difficulties, he's constantly saying what's possible. I like this one here. He says, this from the Samyutta Nikaya. He says, the lazy person dwells in suffering, soiled by evil, unwholesome states, and great is the personal good that he neglects. But the energetic person dwells happily, secluded from evil, unwholesome states, and great is the personal good that he or she achieves. It is not by the inferior that the Supreme is attained. Rather, it is by Supreme that the Supreme is attained. This holy life is a beverage of cream. Therefore, monastics, arouse your energy for the attainment of the as yet unattained, for the achievement of the as yet unachieved, for the realization of the as yet unrealized, with the thought, in such a way, this going forth of ours will not be barren, but fruitful and fertile. Just sit for a minute.